Why do we struggle with commitment? Sometimes we can't help thinking the grass is greener elsewhere. Just remember your promises and learn to live in gratitude. It will help your wandering heart. Hey folks, it's Karen G from the Tower Hill Communications team. Thanks for listening in to our Tower Hill podcast. Whenever or wherever you're listening, we hope this podcast gives you inspiration. And we'd love if you share this with someone that you know so that they'll feel inspired too. This is chapter 6 of our sermon series called The Story, which is a condensed chronological version of the Bible chapter by chapter. So let's listen in to Pastor Jason Tucker right now.
So story chapter 6. Last week, we talked a bit about relationships, or at least if you saw the video, I talked about relationships, how we all know from an early age that relationships and promises are important. And if I were to ask any kid what's a promise, they would totally understand it, especially a pinky swear. Right? When I was a kid, it was like, not only can you trust me, but like, this is like life or death right here. This little guy. If we pinky swear, it really means something. I'm going to do what I promised I'm going to do no matter what, which I think is a step up from like my parents' generation who are like, spit on it. Like, super, super gross. Anyway. Yeah, so the pinky swear. And I was thinking about the idea of promises, and this is why God, by the way, delivers the Ten Commandments. We don't usually think about it like that. We don't think about the Ten Commandments as like a relationship pinky swear promise in a way. We usually think, oh, no, it's all about God wants to give us rules so we don't screw up and, you know, we have to, if we don't live by the rules and we get zapped, you know, and that's just how it goes and that's what God is like. But actually, it's not like that at all. I was thinking about relationships. How relationships always move from a place of being informal to a place of formality. And as you go along that process, the promises ratchet up. They become more and more formal, the more trust you have. So let's say you're just starting to date somebody. And you're just like, yeah, we're dating. Yeah, we're seeing each other. Yeah, it's kind of, you know, I don't know, it's not exclusive or anything. We're just kind of hanging out, getting dinner. But then at some point, it's like, no, we're a couple. Which means now it's gone from something really casual and informal to it's gone up a level. Well, we're not just seeing other people. We are seeing each other exclusively. There's a promise in there. I'm not going to go casually date other people because I'm committed to a relationship with you. Right? So then you keep going. Then it's proposal time. And that gets real formal because now you got some bling involved and you've got a significant investment in that ring. There are some promises. Like, we are promising we are going to get married. And you see, like, it gets a little more formal. The love actually grows the more formal it gets. But the promises get more and more formal. Like, this is a pact that we're making. This is a promise that we're making. Then, of course, the wedding day. It's like, we're all in. We hired the DJ. There is no backing out. Can I just tell you, I love it when couples, if you're considering getting married, have a live band if you can. I'm just kidding. There's probably like 5 DJs in here. Hey, what's up with you? No. Not all DJs are created the same. I'm sure you're wonderful. So informal to formal, and then you get to wedding day, and that is formal. It's a contract. We're saying our vows to promise to what? To love each other. Not because we want to be bound by a contract, but because we want our love to be cemented. We want to be bound together. We want to make these promises that we're going to love each other like this the rest of our lives, no matter what. So that becomes very formal. And here's the piece that often gets lost when we talk about like the Ten Commandments and God's law in the Old Testament. It all feels like it's just kind of a big buzzkill. It's here to ruin our good time as human beings, and it's so strict, and nobody can follow it, and what kind of God? No. It's God saying, I'm not just doing this with everybody right now. I will. I will one day offer my grace and forgiveness to everybody, but for now, I've got to teach the world what grace and forgiveness are all about. I got to teach them what sin is. I got to teach them how to live in relationship with me. And so God just kind of like proposes. He's like, do you want to be in this covenant promise relationship? That's what's going on in the Ten Commandments. And what do they say? They said, I do. They said, I do. God wanted to make it official. He chooses to live in a covenant relationship with us. And then the people said, I do. That's what's going on in Exodus 24:7. If you go to the next slide. Then Moses took the book of the covenant and read it to the people. They responded, we will do everything the Lord has said. We will obey. They said, yes, okay. We will be in this covenant special promise relationship with you. But why you say yes to a promise matters. I'll put it this way. The Israelites got themselves into the promise because of what they thought God could do for them. They wanted the promised land. I'm not calling them gold diggers, but kind of. They got married because of what the marriage gave to them. Hey, we are the exclusive people of God. Hey, he already did miraculous things. Remember that Red Sea thing? That was awesome. All right, let's hitch our wagon to this one. Because he's going to give us what we all want. We want the promised land. The problem is when you base the promise on what you get, it does some damage to the relationship. Or maybe it's sort of like The Voice. You guys all watch The Voice? Anybody watch The Voice? All right. So if you've never seen The Voice, we'll get you a TV. Sorry. If you've never seen The Voice, the whole premise of the show is they take these contestants, it's a competition, and these people who are trying to be aspiring stars, and they sing, and these celebrity judges, who are all singers, all very famous, they have their backs to the contestant, and they hear the person sing, and if they like their voice, they'll turn around and say, hey, I want you to work with me because I'm going to get you to win this competition. Now, sometimes the contestant, and like, if a celebrity ever did that to me, I don't care what it is. I'd be like, yes, absolutely yes. They don't all say yes. The reason is, whether they're a fan of the celebrity or not, almost doesn't matter. It's do they think that particular celebrity is going to help them get where they want to go? Are they really going to be able to help me win? No, you are asking me to come with you, but I kind of want that one because I think she'll do a better job. In other words, it doesn't matter the status of the celebrity or how much you think of them. It's in the end what you think they're going to do for me. It's a very one-sided relationship. And I feel like that's a little bit what's going on with the Israelites and God. It's a very one-sided relationship. God, first of all, delivers them from slavery before he makes vows and has them agree to this relationship. He leads with love, deliverance, forgiveness. And then he explains, and this is what it looks like now to live in a relationship with me. And the people are like, okay, as long as you're the God amongst the panel that's going to get us where we want to go. You know, it's funny, in my own personal life, when I came to know Jesus, I didn't know anything about God. It started with deliverance, but I didn't understand what that meant for my life until much later. It's funny how God works. Some people think that you have to know everything in order to say yes to God. It's kind of like saying, well, we'll have kids when we're ready. Oh, are you ever really ready? But what God does is he delivers us, he forgives us, and then we start to learn what that covenant relationship is like. And we want to live that way because we love him. We want to honor his commands because we love him. We want to say our vows because we want to make it official. We love him. Just because God brings the law doesn't mean it's like an absence of love. He leads with love. So the Israelites, everything you say we will do, we want to get into the promised land. So here they go. They're only a three-day journey to the promised land. Now, already, God has miraculously showed up. He provided manna in the wilderness. You probably heard of this. Manna, which literally in Hebrew means, what is it? That's what it means. That's what manna means. What is it? They didn't know what it was. It was some kind of like flaky stuff that they turned into bread. God gave them this manna in the wilderness where there was no food. He provided miraculously for them over and over and over again. Into their three-day journey to the promised land, here's where we pick up the story, Numbers chapter 11. Now the people complained about their hardships in the hearing of the Lord, and when he heard them, his anger was aroused. The rabble with them began to crave other food. And again, the Israelites started wailing and said, if only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost. Really, at no cost. That's what you call slavery? At no cost. Talk about revisionist history. Also, the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. I feel like it was like the crowd, like, don't forget the cucumbers, they were great, and the onions and the leeks. It's a very specific list, and the garlic. But now we have lost our appetite. We never see anything but this manna. It's so ridiculous. Manna again? Gee whiz. How could you do this, God? We were having pulled pork sandwiches back in Egypt. Like, how many times we, thanks for the miracle, God. What else you got? This may not have seemed like a big deal, but to God it was. The reason is because this is a symptom of an infection. It's the same symptom that we might find in ourselves from time to time. It's an infection that eventually will kill us. That's the infection of ingratitude to God. If you've ever been in a place in your life, and we all have at one point or another, so you're in good company, where you feel like God should be doing more for you, where God hasn't done right by you in some area, it starts to become a thought that kind of festers and becomes this like open sore of not being grateful for what he's done for you. And as soon as that happens, you are always at a spiritual risk of going off the rails. Gratitude is such a huge calibration device to God's heart. Like, I'm so thankful. I may not be where I hope to be one day, but I'm so thankful for how you brought me this far. And so this ingratitude became a quick spiritual problem with the Israelites. In fact, everything you say we will do quickly becomes, yeah, we'd rather do all this without you. That was a quick marriage. Now, I can't say, wait, is Karen in the room? Okay. I can't say I remember everything I said on my wedding day. It was 18 years ago. But 3 days after that, I'd probably remember most of it. They forgot really quickly. They forgot really quickly the promises that they made with God. Well, if you're not going to get us where we want to go, we'll pick the other one. Because we think the other one's going to get us where we want to go. Everything you say we will do. Nah, we'd rather do it without you. Now, just a question. How would you feel if you were God? I'd be pretty upset. I don't think it's petty of God to be upset at the treatment he's getting. And I think when people read the Old Testament, they have already made up their minds that God's petty and judgy much, God, you know? God's angry. But it's because he's trying to have this relationship and he's doing everything he can to make it happen, and the people are just rejecting him constantly. Now, did God already know ahead of time what he meant? Yes. don't know how that all works, but I know it doesn't feel good. Even if I know, hey, tomorrow I got a feeling my kid's gonna lie about doing his homework because of the way things ended tonight. Even though I know it's coming, doesn't make it any less disappointing when it actually happens. So the situation starts to kind of unravel on the Israelites. Everyone starts complaining, and it kind of is like downward spiral. Even in Moses' inner circle, his brother and sister, Miriam and Aaron, start chirping away at Moses' leadership. And they find a weird way to do it. It's like they're looking for an excuse to discredit their brother. And that is, they start complaining that he married outside the Israelite ethnicity. Remember, when he went, the whole burning bush moment, he had a family. He married a Cushite woman, someone who wasn't an Israelite, wasn't Jewish, wasn't a Hebrew. And now they're choosing to complain. And remember, you know, he married this Cushite woman. Something must have happened where they were upset with her or something, or who knows what it was. We can only guess. But they decide, well, hey, what makes Moses so great anyway? After all, he has this mixed marriage. Isn't that wrong, God? They should marry some. Interestingly, God responds. He ends up punishing them. And he actually says something really important, or he makes this point, that God punishes and exposes an important truth, that God is concerned about a mixed marriage, but not in the way they thought. He was concerned in the mixed marriage of their heart being mixed in their relationship with God. That their heart was not altogether unified in their relationship with God. In other words, they were in a relationship, but they were looking around to upgrade. Constantly. And if you've ever been in a relationship like that, it stinks. It's not what I wanted to say right there. It's a sermon, though, after all. It stinks. It's about the heart of the people. Here's why this is so important. If the people have a mixed or divided heart about God, this whole thing wasn't going to work. Remember what God's doing. This is the part where it gets a little confusing, I know, because we live on the other side of the cross. We have a different relationship with God than we did than the people before the cross. We forget that a little bit sometimes, and we're like, well, wait, why is God being so harsh with sin and all this other? Because it was different. People weren't covered by the forgiveness of Jesus Christ yet. And so he's trying to explain the importance of that as he goes, as he develops the relationship with the people. Because here's the thing, a mixed heart will forever wander because it lacks commitment. It's always looking to upgrade, always looking elsewhere, always got one eye on something that might be better. So you're never really all in the relationship. If you're hedging your bets with God, it's impossible for you to really be in that relationship because you got to be in it. You're either in it or you're not. Let me put that kind of in an everyday example, is that I know there's a lot of people who struggle to say, I'm waiting for God to show me something. I'm waiting for some sort of like proof that this whole thing is real and it's not just a mind game. And this is the hardest part to explain to someone who is not yet all in with God. It's kind of strange. It sounds like circular reasoning, but trust me, it's not. Until you're all in, you don't understand it because you don't really experience it. And I know that sounds like a convenient answer, but it's true. Anybody who's lived that's true. It's like if you're just waiting out here for God to do something to convince you, you're not really going to be convinced. Most likely, I mean, God's going to do anything he wants. But most likely, it's not until like, what are you talking about? You don't really know what you're talking about until you're in the relationship. Say, okay. And so what I tell people is, what if you took the next 30 days and acted like it was all true? 30-day trial and see if you want to buy. 30 days, act like it's all true. I challenge you, anybody who does that, to after 30 days say, no, it's not true, I'm out. Because you experience things, you experience God when you're in the relationship. If you're always looking for the eye on something better, you're not really in it. Trust is the linchpin that keeps the wheels of faith turning. So, God's getting ready to actually give them the promised land. He's got it teed up for them to take. But there's people living in the promised land, and they aren't so convinced that they're going to be able to kick them out. So now we go to Numbers chapter 13. They send scouts to go look at the land and say, is it really as good as God said? Is it really worth it? And what are the people like there? Are they like very small people? Are they like cowardly, weakling people? That would be nice. So they come back with the report. They came back to Moses and Aaron and the whole Israelite community at Kadesh in the desert of Paran. There they reported to them and to the whole assembly and showed them the fruit of the land. They gave Moses this account. We went into the land to which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here is its fruit. But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there. There was a kind of like a ghost story about the people of Anak, that they were like a race of giants. So this was kind of playing into their fear about what's the worst possible situation we could face, like a race of giants to fight against, like a whole bunch of Goliaths, basically. The Amalekites live in the Negev, the Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites live in the hill country, and the Canaanites live near the sea and along the Jordan. Then Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, we should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it. But the men who had gone up with him said, we can't attack those people. They are stronger than we are. And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they had explored. They said, the land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there, the descendants of Anak, come from the Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them. Now, you might think, well, it's okay to be a little apprehensive and scared, but no. God needed to make sure that they fully trusted him, and they clearly did not. They had a mixed heart in their relationship with God. They did not trust. In the end, they did not trust that God's pinky swear meant anything. And so there were consequences. A mixed heart will always wander, and now begins the wandering of the Israelites in the wilderness. God says, this generation doesn't trust me. We're going to wait it out for 40 years until you do. I find it fascinating that God was ready to give them the promised land after the three-day wander. But he knew if he gave it to them with a mixed heart, it would be a disaster. Right. I wonder, maybe you wonder this for yourself, how many blessings is God waiting to give me? I'm just not ready to handle them. Because if I'm not ready to handle it, it could ruin me. So God actually, out of mercy, doesn't send them to get slaughtered. He has them wait until they're ready to trust. There's just too much at stake. So God wanted their whole hearts in. They're all in commitment. And by the way, wouldn't you? Just think about the context of marriage. You don't want on your wedding day to be like, I solemnly vow to give a very tiny portion of my heart to you forever and ever until I decide otherwise. Love you. Right? It would not go over so well. God wanted them all in the relationship. After all, the relationship had been made formal. And then everything just sort of derails, like Numbers 25, 1 and 2. All these things start happening, and the people start just sinning with reckless abandon. There's all this like sexual immorality, and go ahead and go to the next slide. While Israel was staying in Shittim, the men began to indulge in sexual immorality with the Moabite women. Keep going. Who invited them to the sacrifices to their gods. The people ate the sacrificial meal and bowed down before these gods. So, I mean, you just see everything just kind of gets unhinged. They're unfaithful. It's infidelity, and that's what happens from a mixed heart. Even Moses struggled with a mixed heart at one point. God was going to have him do this miraculous thing, again, for the people to quench their thirst. He was going to take his staff and touch the rock, and water would come out. This had happened before. But the way Moses approached it was like he didn't really listen to God. He did it his own way. And it was kind of a little act of rebellion. And God punished Moses for this. He said, listen, you're the head person that everyone's looking at. And you're showing that you have a mixed heart. We can't do it. You know, and God had a special relationship with Moses. He said that, and it was, they were the ones who only saw him. It said Moses was the one who saw him face to face. Like there was an intimacy with him and Moses. But God said, I can't, you're not going to get to go into the promised land. It's really cool. God does show Moses the promised land so he gets to see it, which is kind of a neat moment at the end of his life. But there are serious consequences for not trusting in God because he just simply can't give you the promised land. He can't give you the blessings until you're ready to handle it. So God wants to solve the heart problem, but how do you repair it? How do you fix it? How do you change a mixed heart? And this is really what the rest of Scripture is all about. Now that they understand how broken they are because of the vows that they can't keep, the commandments they can't keep, then they understand that, okay, God needs to fix this. And the rest of the story is God doing what he can to fix what's broken in humanity. To do it for us because we can't do it for ourselves. That's someone who took their vows seriously. So the remedy that he gave to God's people, which is really cool, is a prayer. It's like a recalibration prayer from Deuteronomy chapter 6. This prayer, every Israelite would know, all the children, everyone, every day they would recite it. In fact, to this day, many Jewish people will recite this prayer every single day. It's called the Shema, comes from Deuteronomy 6. And it's a way of recalibrating your heart to God every day. It goes like this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. Right? It's a recalibration prayer. In fact, it's this prayer that Jesus quotes when he was asked, what's the greatest commandment? Maybe some of you remember that moment. Someone tries to trick him. What's the greatest commandment? He says, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second one is like it, to love your neighbor as yourself. He's quoting from the Shema. They all would have known that prayer. And then here's what he says about it. These commandments that I give you today are to be on your, what? Hearts. I'm not giving you commandments so that you can know them here. Because it's in the context of a relationship. I want your heart. This is why we made these vows. Because I love you, and I want you to love me. And in order to cement our love, we make promises to one another. Let these commandments be on your hearts. Let these wedding vows be on your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. When the Lord your God brings you into the land he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you a land with large, flourishing cities you did not build, houses filled with all kinds of good things you did not provide, wells you did not dig, and vineyards and olive groves you did not plant, then when you eat and are satisfied, be careful that you do not forget the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. So, what does the Shema teach us about how to have a pure heart in your relationship with God? What do these scriptures say? A few things real quick. The first is, make God first. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. That's where we start. God is first. The second, remember what God has done for you. Tie them as symbols, it says. Make it a part of your everyday ritual. Remember what God has done for you. The next one, talk about it often. Impress it upon your kids. Talk about how grateful you are for what God has done. And that's the next thing, is live into the gratitude. Remember, ingratitude was the problem in the first place. Live into that gratitude. So what does it mean? It's like, God, listen, I ask your prayers in these areas of my life. I know that things aren't exactly like I wish them to be, but I just want to say thank you, and I love you. And I ask that you help me to live out that love faithfully. And man, that'll change your life. Remember your vows to the one who loves you. And just like a marriage, every single day is a reaffirmation of those vows. Now, some of you, you maybe grew up in church, and you told God you loved him years ago. But maybe now you're feeling a little distant from God, or maybe you've been feeling cold in your relationship with God, or you have all this doubt that feels like it's just a barrier to you and God. Listen, it's just like any relationship. If all I did was tell my wife I loved her on our wedding day, our marriage would not have lasted this long. Faithfulness yesterday is great, but faithfulness today is what matters. And I don't think it has to be complicated. What if this week, what if this is a place to start? Pick one thing that you're grateful for, just one. It could be something small, it could be something big, just one thing. What if every day, beginning today until next Sunday, you said, even just a one-sentence prayer, God, thank you for, and then fill in the blank. You will be amazed at what that does to your heart. It resets it. It reminds you of what matters most. It reminds you of what God's done for you. And it gives you an opportunity to say you're thankful and that you love him today. Just like any relationship, when you start doing that, you're going to feel closer to God. Almost instantly. This is a really important chapter in our story.